Yesterday, I was reading a law bulletin on, of all things, housing. But this one read more like a Stephen King novel than your typical legal explanation. Some 20 years ago, Housing Authority of Kansas City residents shared space with rats, mice, and cockroaches. Plumbing and electrical neglect put people at health and safety risk. Vagrancy and drug use became problems in unrented units, unsecured units. And there were claims that people of color were being segregated. It all came to a head in 1993 when the courts took control of the Housing Authority. That was then. Well, now the authority is about to be free of the judge-ordered receivership, and the Housing Authority of Kansas City may just be a model for other communities. We're going to find out in this half hour of Central Standard. Good morning. I'm Bill Anderson. A key figure in that turnaround is the managing attorney for Legal Aid of Western Missouri, Julie Levin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Julie filed a class action suit back in 1989 to right the wrong, to eliminate what had become reprehensible living conditions. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what was happening in 1989 that prompted you to move to a class action lawsuit?
Sure, Bill. In 1988, several tenants of a public housing development called Theron v. Watkins came to my office to complain about conditions at their development. I went to their development and walked the grounds and started going through the buildings. And out of 288 units at the development, 120 of those units were vacant. They were not boarded up. They were there was evidence of drug paraphernalia, rats, clothing, Sterno cans. There was evidence that people were living there who were not tenants.
Mm-hmm.
And the residents of the development were afraid to let their children go out during the day, let alone at night. So I tried for about a year to get the Housing Authority and HUD to fix the units, to repair the units, and to make safe, decent, sanitary housing, which is their legal obligation. To no avail. So in January of 1989, I filed a class action lawsuit against the Housing Authority of Kansas City, Missouri, and HUD for maintaining these uninhabitable conditions and also for creating what we call a de facto demolition. In other words, the units were, in essence, being demolished without the Housing Authority going through the proper legal channels mm-hmm. to get approval from HUD to demolish the units. Another part of the lawsuit was that the uninhabitable conditions created what we call a disparate effect or a bad effect on minorities because Theron v. Watkins was inhabited primarily by minority residents.
Mm-hmm.
And the Section 8 program in public housing at that time, the Section 8 voucher program, where tenants are given a voucher from the Housing Authority and allowed to go find a private landlord, in which they would use the voucher, that program of the Housing Authority was far more given to non-minorities.
So let me get this straight. Minorities were being steered towards the public housing project. Other people were being given the opportunity or at least being told about Section 8 availability.
That's correct.
Which is generally single-family dwelling.
That's correct, although
yeah.
It could be a multi-apartment.
Okay.
It's just that a private landlord will take the voucher and the Housing Authority will pay the difference between the tenant's contribution and the rent.
Right. Okay. So what was taking place? Why did this happen? And why in Kansas City, of all places? It just sounds like a complete mismanagement. People, maybe there was a patronage system in place at the board level. What was going on?
That's exactly right, Bill. There was a patronage system at the board level. Board members were giving private contracts to their friends or cronies. The board was totally dysfunctional. The Housing Authority just didn't seem to have the funds, the resources from HUD in order to make the repairs. So it was dysfunction at all levels.
Okay. So we're talking about, I mentioned in the outset, plumbing and electrical safety risks, essentially.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Safety risks at all levels, electrical, plumbing, rotted wood, you name it. They had that problem.
And why was there a vacancy? I think it was something like 50%?
Close. There were about – it was approximately 40% vacancies at Theron B. Watkins and also at the other developments, at many of the other developments. All told, the Housing Authority had a 40% vacancy rate. And these are units that poor people needed to live in. The waiting list was filled with people who wanted to move into public housing but couldn't. And so the class action lawsuit was filed on behalf of both public housing residents who lived in these uninhabitable conditions and also applicants who wanted access to these units that were vacant.
Julie, how many units are we talking about within the Housing Authority of Kansas City? And at this point in time, how many people were affected by these conditions?
Well, there were about 1,900 units or a little under 1,900 units of public housing, and the number of people affected would be all those 1,900 families, so it was approximately 5,000 people who were living in public housing.
Mm-hmm. And these people were essentially trapped, right? I mean, these are people, in many cases, senior citizens, disabled people, people on a low income who probably didn't have a lot of options beyond public housing.
That's right, Bill. You can't get into public housing unless you have a relatively low income. So absolutely, these were elderly, disabled, low-income people who had no other option. It was a housing of last resort, and it was just horrible.
And if I understand this correctly, before you filed any legal action, you tried to work with the Housing Authority to remedy the situation.
That's correct, yeah. Bill. Back then, when we were allowed to do class action lawsuits, we were required to try and negotiate a lawsuit before we filed it, and that the lawsuit would be your last resort to get the remedy needed for the clients.
Mm-hmm. Now, these conditions weren't necessarily, at this point in time, were not necessarily unique to Kansas City.
That's correct.
Yeah.
There were problems with habitability in other housing authorities, but Kansas City was one of the worst.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what was your initial reaction when you toured one of the units?
Well, I was appalled. I felt sickened by seeing all these children having to live in these conditions, and I just knew I had to do something about it, and I had to do something about it fast.
Mm-hmm. I want to introduce you to Ed Lowndes. He's been on the job as executive director of the Housing Authority of Kansas City for about 12 years. Before that, you were general counsel with the Housing Authority.
Correct. Good morning.
Good morning. So you kind of came in when things were still a little bit on the downturn or on the bad side.
They were just beginning to get better.
Yeah.
I came in October of 95.
Yeah. Why? I mean, you had to know what you were walking into.
To a certain degree, I knew. It was a job change for me. My family relocated from Omaha down here to Kansas City, and
uh-huh.
I was looking for a position, and they had one open, and I was looking – at the time, I was looking for something just to be employed, and when I got my feet into it, it was something I just absolutely enjoyed doing.
Yeah.
Because it was a combination of practicing law, but – the social mission of the Housing Authority. And I think most of the employees today, that's why they do come work for us. It's a combination of the profession and the mission.
So there's a lot of passion within your organization.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wait, so what was your initial observation? What was an eye-opener for you? You know, perhaps it was day one on the job as general counsel.
Actually, it was the day of my interview for the position was a day that the Housing Authority was taking applications. And I went to the main facility, the then headquarters, and it was in a lot of disarray. There were literally hundreds of people that were coming to apply, and there seemed to be no order as to what was going on. But mm-hmm. there was somewhere in the background there was some order. But it was literally one of those, what am I walking into?
Right. Ed Lowndes is the executive director of the Housing Authority of Kansas City. He's been in that position for about 12 years now. Perhaps you lived there 20 years ago or beyond. Tell us about your experience. Contrast it to your experience today. 816-235-2888. Call us at 235-2888. Also with us, Julie Levin. She's managing attorney for Legal Aid of Western Missouri. Julie filed a class action suit against the Housing Authority of Kansas City some 20 years ago. The intent was to improve conditions for residents in public housing. Would you say, Julie, that you're happy with where the Housing Authority of Kansas City is today?
I'm very happy with where the Housing Authority of Kansas City is today. Vacancy rate right now at the Housing Authority is 1%. So So they went from over 40% vacancy to 1% vacancy. The crime in housing, in public housing today, is less than the crime in overall city. And that was the complete opposite back in 1989 when the lawsuit was filed. One thing that I will mention is there was a settlement of the case in 1991, and the Housing Authority was ordered to renovate Theron B. Watkins, the subject of the lawsuit, and to desegregate public housing in Kansas City. Because the Housing Authority violated that court order in 1991.
Ignored it, essentially.
Ignored it, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In 1992, I filed a motion to have the Housing Authority and HUD, both defendants in the lawsuit, held in contempt of court for violating the consent decree, the court order. And I should say here that Judge Dean Whipple has been the judge in this case from the outset, and he has just been a fantastic administrator of the Housing Authority and of the lawsuit, overseer, I should say. He's been very compassionate towards the residents, and his whole goal has been to improve conditions for the residents. And so in 1992, he held the Housing Authority and HUD in contempt of court and gave them 6 months to comply with the court order.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't, and so I filed another motion to have the Housing Authority held in contempt of court. And we had a hearing in July of 1993, and at that time, at that court hearing, contempt hearing, I asked the judge to place the Housing Authority in receivership. And the judge agreed, and he did place the Housing Authority in receivership in 1993.
And that's when TAG Associates came into play?
TAG Associates came as the receiver in September of 1994.
Yeah.
In 1993, Magistrate Judge Robert E. Larson became the temporary receiver until we were able to find a receiver who could handle the Housing Authority.
Now, who is TAG? What is TAG?
TAG is a consulting firm run by Jeff Lines, and he's the president and owner of the consulting firm. And he had, at the time, he had a lot of experience in consulting for housing authorities.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on a committee with other people from the community to interview different organizations and agencies and businesses that had applied to be the receiver of Kansas City. And TAG was by far the most experienced and the best firm for. And so the committee recommended to Judge Whipple that TAG be appointed, and the judge did appoint TAG Associates.
And we should mention that HUD is the Housing and Urban Development organization run by the federal government, which really is kind of a source ed for a lot of the money, or most of the money. That
virtually all the money. Our funding comes primarily through the federal government, through Housing and Urban Development, and the rents paid by the tenants.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you're right. That they're the federal funding. The Housing Authority is a separate government organization, under state statute. So we're not part of HUD, but we are funded by and regulated by HUD.
Yeah. Now, you know, it just blows my mind that there is a 50% vacancy. Was there a motivation behind that, or was it just simply people were too busy lining their own pockets to care that these units were going unrepaired and people weren't being moved in? Help us understand that.
It was a combination of all those factors. You had
okay.
people who were working for the Housing Authority who were lining their pockets and didn't care about the residents.
Mm-hmm.
You had a board that was hiring their own cronies to handle contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So the work that was being done was not being done well.
Mm-hmm.
Any repairs that were made were not done well. And you just had sort of a disinterested city.
Did anyone go to prison over this?
No.
Yeah.
Although on the day that the Housing Authority was placed in receivership, the judge, Judge Whipple, ordered the FBI to go out to the Housing Authority and seize their computers and documents.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, nobody went to prison over this.
Ed, what are the qualifications one has to meet to get on a waiting list? You've got a 1% occupancy availability. What does it take to qualify to live in one of these housing units?
Well, as Julie mentioned, the primary qualifications to live in public housing or receive a Section 8 housing assistance voucher is income. Mm-hmm. And that's based on a what they call 80% of the area mean income. It's a amount that's figured out by HUD, and they publish every year, and it adjusts.
Okay.
And if you're below 80% of the median income for the city, you qualify from an income basis.
Okay.
Most of the families that we serve are down around the 10% area median income, or making less than when they're applying, making $5,000, $6,000 a year. And that's from all income sources. Mm-hmm. So that the other qualifications, primary qualification to come in is you cannot have a criminal background relating to drug-related charges or violent criminal activity within the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also some other social aspects that we do review as a landlord would. But those are the two primary qualifications to become eligible.
And you're obligated. You mentioned you do a check, a criminal background check.
Yes, we do.
You're obligated to provide not only a clean place, but a safe, and I think your website says decent, environment for people to live in.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, the Julie used the terminology that I think is rather archaic, but it's, you know, safe, decent, sanitary housing. Our version is it's quality housing where people want to live.
Right.
And safety is one of the primary factors of that, that people have. We want to provide a home, not just four walls and a roof, a place that people know that they have stability in their lives.
Because
that's ultimately what our mission is to provide that initial stability so people can have that foundation in the community, then be able to move on and realize their dreams.
Give us a snapshot of, how many properties you manage, and generally speaking, how large are these properties? I go to a lot of large American cities, maybe not so much here in the year 2013, but I recall as recently as maybe 15 years ago, going into these large cities and seeing these huge high-rise projects that were public housing and that had problems of their own that we'll get into here in a moment.
Sure.
But tell us about the Kansas City landscape.
Well, back in 1993, to start there, the Housing Authority also had its version of those large ones. Wayne Minor was the primary one. It had over 800 public housing units, including high-rises surrounded by apartment, garden-style apartments. Those high-rises were actually taken down, demolished in 1989, and the housing was never replaced. That was one of the issues that Ms. Levin brought up. We have 10 different properties that we have today that are called traditional public housing, and our largest has 232 public housing units in it.
Okay.
So they're much smaller than what you see on the national scale, and they're much more manageable from that standpoint. Some of them are designated as for elderly or disabled only. We have two high-rises in Kansas City that are that way. They're one-bedroom or studio apartments. And then the majority of them are family units that are spread throughout, primarily in the urban core, but still spread out within that urban core of Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, we have 450 what we call scattered site units that are either single-family homes or duplexes, that are literally in every part of the city. When I tell people where we have housing, it's from Kansas City International Airport all the way down to Richards Gebauer, from the Kansas border to the eastern border of Kansas City.
When did HUD, or I'm not sure if it was the housing authorities of the cities across America that did this, but it was determined that these dense populations of high-rise public housing units were a detriment to the people living there, and they became kind of crime-ridden and a difficult place to live. At what point was that realized? And then I know that there was a point in time where all those started being demolished, and I'm thinking of the Caprini Green, which was notorious on the north side of Chicago.
Absolutely. In fact, Caprini Green is still – they're still addressing Caprini Green this day. I think it was probably in the early 90s there was a commission – they call it Commission on Severely Distressed Housing – and it was a study on public housing and how it was, the conditions of it, all the way from the living conditions to the physical conditions. And that led to a program called the HOPE 6 program that was authorized by Congress that dedicated specific federal funds to address those issues.
Mm-hmm.
Kansas City's been very fortunate. We've had four different HOPE 6 grants to address those problems at our developments, the density, the nature of the housing, the amenities in them. Some of the, when I say amenities, I'm not talking like what you see in the suburbs, but simple amenities from the plumbing was now upgraded to where it actually worked, or the gas lines in some of our developments were on the outside of the walls feeding a gas stove. Now they're all enclosed inside the walls for safety purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Those types of things that just needed to create livability, improve the livability standards of the housing.
Across the nation, would you say that we're in a pretty good position and we're offering pretty good housing, public housing?
Absolutely. I belong to an organization with the largest public housing authorities in the country, and there's not only a change in the type of housing, there is a tremendous change in how the housing authorities are operated. The focus on run it as a business, while we don't have a profit, mm-hmm. you run it as a business, and the service we're providing is quality housing, and change of attitude from what do I get out of it to what can I give the people that need this housing.
Mm-hmm. Julie, do you see it the same way? Do you recognize what Ed's sharing with us? Is that your observation?
I do think that housing is probably in a better condition. However, I do think that housing authorities across the country have lost a lot of public housing units. What they've done is they have torn them down, but they haven't replaced them with the same amount of units. Because the Housing Authority in Kansas City was in receivership, the judge issued an order that when there was demolition, the housing authority had to replace it on a one-for-one basis. So for every unit torn down, you had to replace it with a new public housing unit. That was different than any other housing authority in the country. We have lost in the last 10 years over 100,000 units of public housing in this country. And there is this sort of mentality that you don't need to replace it. And that's a very dangerous mentality because we have more people every year who need public housing and it doesn't exist. And the availability of funding for new construction of public housing is not there.
Mm-hmm. Is there a growing need in Kansas City for more units?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think this goes to Julie's comment about the uniqueness of Kansas City. Not only, well, initially it was the court that said we had to replace our units one for one when we demolished or thinned some of the developments. But then I think it really became ingrained in our mission that today, while we only have 1,926 public housing units, I have close to 9,000 families on my wait list.
Wow.
We have the ability to serve about 7,500 families on our voucher program, and I have 14,000 families on that wait list. So, yeah, there is a tremendous growing need, particularly over the last 6-7 years when through the recession, the number of families that are applying that qualify, as well as the number of families that, because of their employment situation, say, well, I want to get on the wait list now because it may be 5 years and I don't know what my employment situation will be 3-5 years from now. But I think it's also a context of we want to provide quality housing. So people are looking at it saying, that is a place that I can live, get back on my feet, and then be able to move out on my own. So it's a combination of things. And I think that's what really sets Kansas City apart from some of those other larger cities, that when they did the thinning out and the demolition, they didn't do the replacement because they didn't see the need. We were trying to be much more futuristic in our vision of saying there's always going to be a need and it's always going to be growing. So how do we provide the housing? And then how do we provide the services so families can move up and out, and the families off the wait list move in?
Yeah. Now, if I have my math correct, you said there are 9,000 people on the waiting list?
Correct.
Okay, and then another 14,000 on the waiting list for Section 8 housing?
Now, some of those are the same people.
Oh,
they
okay,
can be
some
on
of
both
the same
lists.
People. So what are they doing in the meantime? Are they living in substandard conditions? What's taking place?
It runs the gambit. They are people that are homeless that go from shelter to shelter. The term that we sometimes use in our industry is they sofa surf, or they go from family member to family member or friend to friend. A number of them are living in substandard housing, and a number of them are living in decent housing, but they're paying somewhere 60 to 75% of their funds toward their living arrangements as rent.
That's pretty crazy. The Housing Authority of Kansas City will soon be free from under court-ordered supervision, receivership, really. The court order was made some 20 years ago to remedy unlivable conditions, a patronage system, and even forms of segregation. What does the next 20 years look like for the 25,000 people served by the authority? Stay tuned and find out more. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard on KCUR. And good morning. This is Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. We're talking about reckless past management of the Housing Authority of Kansas City, the court order receivership that followed. And we're talking about the present because the authority is about to be free of that court order. The Housing Authority's executive director, Ed Lowndes, is here. So is Julie Levin of Legal Aid of Western Missouri. It was back in the late 80s that Julie filed a class action suit against the Housing Authority and HUD in order to improve living conditions for the residents of Kansas City. Do you live there? Can you compare your experience back then to what it is today? We'd like to hear from you. We'd like to talk to you at 816-235-2888, 235-2888. So you know, generally speaking, you said there's a big need for more housing, but in the age of sequesters and tight budgets, that's probably not going to be part of your reality.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about that is we always figure out a way to make it work. And we are suffering from the sequester. We had a tremendous reduction in our funding. But it is our primary mission is use the funding that we have to preserve the housing that we have. And then through partnerships, private developers working with the city and other entities to find ways to increase the amount of affordable housing. It won't be in the form of public housing, but affordable housing, housing that those families that are at the lower end of the income scale can now afford quality housing. So through those partnerships, we can increase the amount of housing that is out there.
We should clarify that you're independent of the city. However, the mayor does select your appoint board members.
That is correct. Yeah. And that's one of the changes that also occurred in the past. The mayor himself just could appoint anybody he wanted without any kind of qualifications and so forth. And I think that's what happened in the early 90s and all through the 80s. The state statutes were changed that now the mayor can appoint only individuals that come through a screening committee that are then submitted to him so that the screening committee can find qualified individuals. But the mayor ultimately appoints, and then once they're appointed, we are independent.
Well, Jack is joining us from Mission, and he has a question about the board makeup. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I'm just curious. I'd like to ask Julie what the racial makeup was of the board at the time that she filed these complaints, because I'm curious as to whether there was any evidence of white discrimination or whether board members were just simply patronage-driven, bribe-driven, whatever, semi-criminals.
There were seven board members, and two of those board members were African-American. So I don't think there was racism in the composition of the board itself. It really just went to complete mismanagement of the organization.
Got it. Thanks.
And Michelle joins us. She's calling from Northeast Kansas City. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. How are y'all this morning? I've been in Northeast my entire life, and you guys may realize there are several projects, housing projects in my neighborhood. And I've had friends live in Gwinnett, Choteau, Riverview, T.B. Watkins, or Parker Square. And when I was a child, we never had a problem driving to the projects. My friends lived there. I went there, visited them. But they were always almost majority African-American. But then I noticed in the late 80s, when crack cocaine hit, it got so dangerous. My dad actually had to, he got stopped in Riverview, and they just decimated his truck with rocks, little kids, beat him up, beat up some guy. Wouldn't even drive through Choteau anymore when I had friends that lived there. And then after the lawsuit, I went away to college. I come back. I couldn't believe the difference. Hmm. I mean, it was, I mean, I like the projects in my neighborhood now better than the private-owned apartment buildings. Well, and I do have a problem with the Section 8 voucher program, though.
Okay.
Go ahead.
It seems like the private owners who have the Section 8 vouchers don't feel a need to maintain the property as good as the projects are maintained. Well, and another big notice I have is there's white people in the projects now. When I was growing up, you never saw that. So I knew that there was something going on there. It couldn't be just poor black people everywhere.
Ed, what are the requirements for a private owner upholding his or her end of the deal regarding conditions in the Section 8 housing?
The quality of the housing is probably the largest issue that we face with private landlords. I want to point out that we have probably 3,000 different private landlords in the Kansas City area that participate, and the vast majority of them do provide quality housing. But we do have those that don't, and we go out at least once a year, and we go out frequently on complaint inspections to make sure that they are providing quality housing. Under the law, they have 30 days to correct mistakes and bring that back up to quality. And if they don't do it with that, we stop paying them. But if they make the corrections, then we continue to pay them. And then we have to rely on either the neighborhood, the neighbors, or the residents specifically to say this landlord's not living up to their end of the bargain. And we've taken in the past steps to say we will never do business with that landlord again. And we work with the tenant for them to move out mm-hmm. to a new place. But then we won't do business with that landlord.
Julie, does Legal Aid of Western Missouri still have a relationship with the Housing Authority of Kansas City?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Part of the result of the receivership was that it opened up the lawsuit from just centering on Theron B. Watkins to all of the developments. The receiver was responsible for overseeing all of the contracts, all of the operations of every single public housing unit. And that broadened the lawsuit. I am the attorney for the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. The lawsuit is still active and open. The case has not been dismissed. The receivership is going to continue until May 1st, 2014, and then the lawsuit will be dismissed May 1st, 2015, according to the judge's recent order.
Provided
that everything
change.
Goes well. If yeah. there are problems that occur, we can bring the receiver back in. But throughout the lawsuit, my job as plaintiff's attorney has been to monitor all the policies and procedures, to work with the housing authority to make sure all the construction was done and the conditions were improved. And that's been very active case for me and for us. So our role continues. Since the case is still open and the receivership really is still in existence, our role will continue. And I represent the Public Housing Resident Council, which is a wonderful organization of resident leaders of all tenant associations in public housing.
Okay.
And we meet with the Housing Authority once a month and go over all the issues and the good things and the bad things and talk about resolutions of things. And the Housing Authority will include us in all the policies and procedures that they want to implement that affect the residents. And we submit comments on those and try to negotiate things. So there is a very active relationship between the Housing Authority and my clients and me.
I think it's widely recognized that the receivership has been a good thing. However, Ed, does it kind of present some obstacles, some challenges, maybe even financial obstacles for you? Or
well, of course, with a receiver, they're paid a fee, and
yeah.
that'll change over time. But it's I think it's the funds that have been paid out have been well worth it, and the amount of funding that actually through the receivership and TAG Associates' contacts and just their background, the funds that we've been able to tap into has been more than we've gotten more return on what we've ever invested, and I look mm-hmm. at it as that. I think the biggest thing we have now, it is a transition. It is moving from the oversight of the court to an independent, and that's with the new board in place, and they're responsible for the governance of it. I'm responsible for the day-to-day activities of everything at it. And there's a certain level of apprehension, both of staff, the community, and the residents. But I think that's one of the things that we've repaired over the last 20 years is our relationships with the residents first mm-hmm. and the community as a whole, that by working together, we'll find that we'll continue to maintain on the path we are of being one of the best housing authorities in the country.
You probably inherited a demoralized staff when you came on board back in, what was it, 93?
I actually came in 1995.
95.
So I've been there not quite 18 years.
Yeah.
And yes, it was quite different. I think the staff turnover rate was probably 40%. And it was trying to find the right mix of the people that had both the qualifications and the dedication to do it. And the staff that I have now is extremely stable, particularly my leadership staff, highly qualified, very dedicated, and they in turn work with their line staff to make sure that we do what we're supposed to do. You always have those that want to take a different path, and we deal quickly with that because ultimately we're mission-driven and we have to provide services to those that need us.
So right now, what would you say is the biggest challenge you face?
We touched on it a moment ago, and that's funding.
Yeah.
It is trying to find a way to use the limited funding that we have to maintain the quality of housing and knowing that it is part of a community. We're not standalone. Which is probably the second biggest challenge we face, and that is changing the psychological or mindset of the families that live, particularly in public housing, that typically think they are public housing residents, not mm-hmm. citizens of Kansas City, but some lower class. And it's like our challenge is we want you to be part of the total community, experience everything the city has to offer, have a dream, realize your dream, and then the next family can move in behind you and do that too. So that's probably our biggest challenge, one on the financial side, and the other is on the direct services side.
Beyond housing and urban development department, at the federal level, mm-hmm. what sources of revenue do you have access to?
Well, that's something that we are moving more and more into. It's whether directly or indirectly, and we are now tapping into Health and Human Services Department funding. We don't apply directly for that, but through partnerships of other not-for-profit organizations or education, we have great partnership with UMKC, with Kansas University to provide various services. We also work with the Department of Labor. We have a fantastic program called Youth Build that works with young men and women between 16 and 21 of learning the construction trade, as well as earning their GED or high school diploma. But that's using Department of Labor funds to do that. So we took an approach of don't focus just on HUD money. Go for anything and everything that's out there for all the services.
And just a few minutes ago, you mentioned partnerships.
Yes.
What do those look like?
Oh, they run the gamut. I mentioned earlier the development partnerships. It's usually with a development company for the actual hard construction. But the largest partnership array that we have is on the social services side. The Full Employment Council to bring employment training to the families that we serve, or health services through Samuel Rogers or the Kansas City Bioscience University, just a whole array. And we're always looking for new opportunities to work with the community as a whole. So that, for instance, even with UMKC, it's working with their social services department. We have interns that work with us through the social services, those in school, to come actually do their practicums with us. So it just runs the gambit.
And so you're not actually paying for those services. That's just part of establishing a relationship with other services within the community, correct?
Correct. We're not paying for the – in years past, that's what we did. We actually paid someone to bring the services. Today we're saying these are families that are individuals that you serve through your natural mission. How do we cooperate to make sure that the services those entities provide are being brought to these families that need them so desperately?
What is the average length of time that a tenant remains in the program?
for a family that doesn't have disabilities or other aspects, they're generally there 5 to 7 years in public housing. It's generally 3 to 5 years in the voucher program.
Okay. And a senior who moves into public housing is probably going to remain in public housing until...
Correct.
Until he or she passes.
That's correct.
Yeah.
When you use families that are elderly or have debilitating or disabilities, they're typically there much longer. And one of the ways that we look at our success is not how long that family's been in public housing or using a voucher, but what about their children? Are they coming back into public housing? And we find that the generational aspect has so greatly reduced, and that's a tremendous success, that they're raising their children that they don't expect to live in public housing. They're actually moving up, moving out, and then coming back and helping their parents with their needs.
Mm-hmm. Julie, a few minutes ago, Ed referenced a stigma associated with living in public housing and efforts to change that and to make it a more positive experience. Obviously, what you saw in the late 80s was deplorable, and probably people just dreaded living in that environment. Have you noticed a change in the mindset and the attitude of the people who are living in public housing?
Absolutely. I think that when you live in safe and good conditions, your whole outlook on both your self-esteem and other people changes dramatically. And I've definitely noticed a big difference in how people perceive themselves and their children now than I did when the lawsuit was filed.
Mm-hmm. That has to make you feel pretty good to hear that from Juliet.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think, and that goes to the partnership that, you know, we mentioned partnerships. Our biggest partnership is with the residents and working through Ms. Levin and her helping the residents understand our position in managing, but also their responsibilities as good tenants. And that relationship ultimately helps the entire community.
The two of you seem to have a pretty healthy relationship, a positive relationship, and I wouldn't know why you wouldn't. But, I mean, was there a time where it was a little bit testy?
Well, you know, we are adversaries in that the Housing Authority was a defendant in a lawsuit.
Yes.
But with the receiver and with Ed coming in as executive director, by that point, the adversarialness was actually subsided tremendously. I mean, they were part of the solution.
We're doing a group hug now, folks.
They were part of the solution. They wanted the same thing that the tenants wanted. Certainly, we disagree with things, with all the different policies and procedures that go on at the Housing Authority. We have issues that come up. But the big difference is there's mutual respect and a mutual desire to resolve things for the betterment of the residents and the Housing Authority. The Housing Authority's properties and its reputation would never have changed without the help of the residents. Mm-hmm. And so it had to become a partnership so that everyone was working for the same reason, towards the same goal.
Is this a model for the rest of the nation?
I think so.
Yeah. What makes it different?
Well, first, hopefully it's a model without having to go through receivership.
Yeah.
I think the underlying aspects of what we do, the attitude, is a model for the rest of the country of you put your mission first, and that is serving families that can't otherwise find housing on their own. You find ways to make it work, working together, treating people with respect and integrity and honesty aspects of it. And when you put all those things together, whether it's, a Sprint, a major corporation like Sprint, or if it's a housing authority, when you put all those things together, then you're successful. And then your customers or your residents want to help you be successful as well.
Thanks for joining KCUR. This is Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. Today we're talking about the Housing Authority of Kansas City. It's about to be free of a court-ordered oversight. That will take place again when, Julie?
The court oversight will take place in May 1 of 2015.
Okay.
The receivership will end May 1, 2014. And I also just wanted to add something,
sure,
Bill. The Housing Authority never would have turned around without Jeff Lyons, the receiver. now then special master, now monitor. It took the assistance of all the groups, Ed Lowndes, the receiver, the residents, Judge Whipple. All of these conditions created a perfect environment for Housing Authority of Kansas City now being a model to the country.
Let's go back to the phone lines and talk to Susan in Kansas City.
Good morning. I have one quick question. We talked about the public housing units owned and operated by the Housing Authority, but we did not touch upon the 3,000 private landowners that do contract with the Housing Authority. Many of these landlords own multi-unit apartment buildings. How do you make sure that they don't become quasi-public housing and negatively impacting the neighborhoods, which is happening? Is there a formula that you use, like, say, 200 units, you only get 10%, or do you just stick as many as you can in there? I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, the Housing Choice Voucher program is designed that the individual that receives it can use that anywhere in the city that they want. So it really is the form of a rental assistance program, and the individuals select an apartment or where they like to live, the same as anyone else would. And there is not a formula or a tipping part where we say you have so many voucher holders in this apartment complex. Part of the theory, the aspect of that is when somebody, just because they're lower income, doesn't mean they're a poor tenant or a bad tenant or someone that you should not invite or enjoy in your neighborhood. Where it really becomes an issue is when landlords don't enforce their own lease. The same as they would with anyone else. And that's part of our objective as well, of holding that landlord to his obligation to enforce the lease. So if he allows someone that's on our program, has a voucher, and they're now getting into criminal activity or they're doing something else, and the landlord doesn't enforce the lease and no one else reports to the Housing Authority that we can take enforcement action, then you are going to have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if residents or neighbors report to us, they believe there's this activity, first we'll check to make sure that they are one of our voucher holders. Then we will do program enforcement, which includes terminating that person from participating in the program. But to the question of is there a limitation on how many tenants or voucher holders a person can have, no. That person gets to choose where they want to live.
Okay. I would think that the area where you'd be most inclined to have problems would be in those relationships with the private homeowners.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
We do. And that's a relationship and working with the total community of where do I go or who do I talk to if I'm having a problem. I'm pleased to say most of the complaints that we have turn out not to be one of our tenants.
Good.
But we still look into it. We take every complaint seriously. We look to see if it is one of our tenants. We also make sure that complaints, whether it's regarding conditions of the property or some other activity, also get referred to the other proper authorities, whether it's the City Codes Department or if it's criminal activity, the Kansas City Police Department. And we have an excellent relationship with the police department. That if a crime involves one of our clients or one of our residents, through my public safety department, they relay that information so we can take program enforcement action.
And you have public safety engagement on the premises.
I have a staff of four public safety officers. They are not police. They're retired police officers, but they do not act as a police force. They act as liaisons with the Kansas City Police Department. So if there's criminal activity, they contact the police department. And there are officers assigned to that general region that we have an excellent relationship with, and they will take the appropriate law enforcement actions.
I'm going to give you each 1 minute to respond to this next question. I'll start with you, Julie. If you could wave that magic wand and do something today for the Housing Authority, what would that be?
I would get a lot more funding for it so they could build more public housing to serve all the needy people who are on the waiting list.
Ed?
Funding, definitely. The modification I would have to Julie's comment is it's building more mixed income arrangements that you have a variety of incomes, a variety of opportunities for families to see how other people live and establish that environment. It would be expanding our role in the total community and the total housing environment. arena within the city of Kansas City beyond just public housing.
Mm-hmm. And we do have time for one more question, Julie. Do you feel that adequate checks and balances are now in place that will kind of protect the integrity of the housing authority to prevent what happened 20-plus years ago from happening again?
I do. I think that the Board of Commissioners now is completely different type of board than there was before. There are legislative requirements for the makeup of the board. And the board is a very important factor towards the running of a housing authority. So, and also we have a city that's more engaged in public housing. We have public housing residents who are far more engaged in their living quarters. And so I think that I don't think that what happened back in the 80s and 90s will happen again.
Julie Levin, Managing Attorney for Legal Aid of Western Missouri, thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you.
Ed Lowndes, Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Kansas City, nice to have you in the studios.
My pleasure.
Yes, nicely done, both of you. You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Tune in tomorrow. We'll be exploring a new exhibit at the Kansas City Museum, and we'll look at the production of Spamalot. Up to Date is next with summer reading recommendations for kids of all ages. That includes you, Steve Kraske. Our show today was produced by Suzanne Hogan and Matthew Long Middleton with Claire McInerney and Ross Steinmetz. Kim Noble is our announcer. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard.